Hello, everyone, and welcome to McGill Care's webcast series, Supporting Family and Informal Caregivers. I'm Claire Webster, a former caregiver, certified dementia care consultant, and founder of McGill University's Dementia Education Program. I work with a dynamic team of leading healthcare professionals to oversee the program, who include Dr. José Moret from the Division of Geriatric Medicine, and Dr. Serge Gauthier, Professor Emeritus, formerly of the McGill University Research Center for Studies in Aging. McGill Cares is supported by the Amelia Saputo Community Outreach for Dementia Care. The McGill Dementia Education Program offers a comprehensive range of free resources to educate and support persons living with dementia, family and informal caregivers, healthcare professionals, medical students, and the public at large. One of our most important resources is our Dementia Companion Guide, which is now available in 12 languages. It can be downloaded for free on our website at mcgill.ca/dementia, and printed copies are available on Amazon, and all proceeds go to support our program. We also have numerous other initiatives, such as past episodes of McGill Cares, virtual support groups, dementia activity videos, so all kinds of things. So please go ahead and look, and we've created all these amazing resources to support all of you. So today's topic is really about understanding if your papers are in order. It's understanding the legal, psychosocial, and medical assessments required to make decisions on behalf of another person. This topic can feel quite overwhelming for many people, especially those caring for a person living with dementia. And we are going to really unpack all of the issues related to how to proceed with this very complex situation. So today I'm going to be joined by Stephanie Geller and Anna Camateros, who will help us understand the nuts and bolts of later life planning, including what is required in the event that a person loses their capacity to make important life decisions. Anna Camateros is a notary, is department head for wills, estates, planning at KRB Lawyers. Anna Camateros provides estate and later life planning services that optimize wealth transfer and reduce estate conflicts. Her work with respect to estate planning, including the preparation of final wills and testaments and protection mandates, includes advising liquidators on their duties administering the estate. She is part of the expert committee for the Quebec Chamber of Notaries on the implementation of the law to better protect vulnerable persons. Stephanie Geller is a social worker. She's the team lead clinical social worker at Leanna's Senior Transition Support. She's been working with seniors for the last 25 years, helping them and their families with caregiving issues, including navigating social services, work-life balance issues, stress, anxiety, burnout, and coping through major life decisions. Wow, you both have very important roles. So welcome to McGill Cares.
Thank you.
So we're going to begin with Stephanie, and because the first step in this whole process is really the role of the social worker in terms of working with the family prior to working with the notary. So Stephanie, you know, in your work as a social worker, I imagine that you come across these types of issues quite often, where you need to be called in by a family and have to really do a psychosocial assessment in order for the family to be able to take over the responsibilities of making decisions on behalf of a family member. So perhaps you can just explain a bit of that, and then I'll let you go in and explain and talk about the logistics involved.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I think that ever since COVID, that was a big one. We started to hear a lot more from families about those who did not see their family members for several months and then called us up after seeing them after several months and said, wow, I'm really surprised to see that there has been, in fact, a decline, and that perhaps getting my papers in order now would be the time to look at this. I do also just want to specify that there are social workers in a CLSC versus private social workers like myself. CLSC workers, when they can, they hopefully, as they did before COVID, have been able to do these psychosocial assessments. But unfortunately, things really got backed up, and it looks like more people now are starting to explore the idea of private social workers to get this psychosocial assessment done for the purposes of homologating a mandate or for tutorship. But we're going to go into what exactly all of that means, okay? Okay, so we presented, we have a presentation that's been put together about psychosocial assessments and how the process takes place, which I would like to share with you. And we are just going to go through some of the basics in terms of what's involved during the psychosocial assessment. Now, there might be some overlap with Anna, but I think that she'll probably take on any of the legal piece that we are going to be discussing. Some of the things that we get often get asked about is protection mandates, what that means, tutorship, which I think is also something Anna is going to discuss, homologation, which is the actual activation of by the courts of a protection mandate or tutorship, and a psychosocial assessment process. We leave questions and answers to the end, if that's okay. So a protection mandate is a document that is prepared where a person expresses their wishes and names one or more trusted people to look after their person, which we're going to discuss, and their property in the event that they become incapacitated. So this is done at a time when a person is in fact capable or of capable mind to make this decision, and they are able to name a person or a few people as the people that will be responsible in the event that something happens. Okay. Tutorship is a little bit different. So the tutorship to a person of full age, so we're talking 18 plus, it's a legal measure aimed at ensuring the protection of a person. It's the same type of idea. The administration of their patrimony, the exercise of their rights. It's established by the courts in the event, again, that a person's incapacity would take place and that they need somebody to represent them. So there are two areas that we're looking at for tutorship, and that would include person, which includes personal decisions that would need to be taken care of in the event of incapacity, and there's property. And when we say property, what we're referring to is finances as well. So there's two areas that need to be discussed and decided upon in the event of a person's incapacity if somebody needs to take on responsibility. Okay, this is what I was discussing. There's two areas for tutorship. Tutorship property, which is financial as well, and tutorship to the person. Now, just to give you an example, and Anna might be able to talk about this in her presentation. Some people say, why do I need to do any of this? I already have a power of attorney in place. Why do I need to get involved with this? And one of the reasons is because a power of attorney for the person and or property, which includes finances, includes when a person is capable of making decisions and they want somebody else to make these decisions on their behalf. When you have to go to the courts and install tutorship or a protection mandate by the means of homologating, that in fact means that a person is incapacitated and need to have these legal forms put in place. So a power of attorney, then it becomes null and void once a person is incapable of making these decisions, and in fact a protection mandate or a tutorship takes over the process. Okay, I hope that makes some sense. Okay, so the tutorship of a person of full age, I think we discussed this for a second. It is the legal measure. So for example, for a protection mandate, we are going ahead with homologation, and for a tutorship, we again, there is somebody that will go to court and have somebody who will be their legal representative in the event of incapacity. Okay, so regardless if we're going to go ahead with tutorship or protection mandate, I think the question becomes, at what point do we start the process of a psychosocial assessment? So what I've done is I've shared my screen to show you what an actual psychosocial assessment for a protection mandate looks like, because this is the specific form that needs to be filled out by the public curator's office. There's a similar one for tutorship. However, it is a little bit longer. What I'd like to explain to you is that before we get into the medical piece that needs to be accompanied the protection mandate, this is in fact about 13 page application where a social worker will go in to meet the person who is applying for a protection mandate to the courts. And what we're doing is we're asking a bunch of questions. So the first few pages are things like general demographics, and it will include things like who is the person responsible that has been appointed for this actual individual. And as the application goes on, some of the other questions that we are going to ask, which is why it's really important to have family and or somebody available during the actual interview, is because we're going to ask things like, how do they manage their social skills? What do they do during the day? There's a little bit of questions about their history. Were they ever married? Do you know what year they were married in? How many children, grandchildren, etc. So all of these questions need to be answered in quite a bit of detail so that when the judge is able to see this protection mandate application, they're really able to get a good feeling of if they understand what the person is involved in. And as the application goes on, what we do want to really be clear about is give an idea of where the person got to now from where they were before and how their memory has declined. So for example, it will be like in early 2000, person was able to take care of a lot of their own appointments and their house and things like that. And then we're going to kind of show a bit of a timeline, which will specify up until around now where some of the decline happened. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes it's during COVID that you'll see that the families have come back to us and said, look, we've really seen a decline and I'd like you to ask a client about that. Families are often very concerned when we're going in to do a psychosocial assessment because they're afraid that we're going to either embarrass the client or we're actually going to go in and ask them questions where they don't know the answers. And that's fine. We would often expect that they wouldn't know the answers. But the reason that we're asking the questions is because depending on the way that they answered the questions will also depend on how we document this in the form, and it will explain things. For example, if I ask somebody the question of, do you know who the president of the United States is? A person might say, yeah, that guy. And I would document it in a way that says person was not able to answer the question, but rather answered by saying that guy, which shows that there is in fact a lapse in the memory and that they're not able to answer certain questions. We go in a very careful and sensitive way so that nobody feels embarrassed. Very often I have family members, children usually, that are sitting with their parent and hearing their parent try to answer the questions, and you'll see them get quite teary. It's quite upsetting to them to see that their parents have had now such a decline and that they're not able to answer the question. So we need to be mindful of that as well. Okay. The next question I have is the medical assessment. Now, this is a form that needs to come in with both tutorship and protection mandate. And why this is important is because you need the doctor who sees the client to be able to say that the person is in fact considered incapable of making either their own personal decisions or taking care of their finances. That's a big one. question that I really often get is, well, what if I don't have a family doctor anymore? So how do we answer that? That's a good question. We have a list of a few private doctors so that in the event that you are perhaps on a wait list or that your family doctor or even a memory clinic has said, no, we don't fill out these forms anymore, you could always give us a call. And we are the ones who will give you the names of some of these private doctors that you could connect with to find out if they are able, which often they are, to fill out the forms to conduct the medical assessment. It's both the medical assessment and the psychosocial assessment that need to be sent in to the courts in order to activate or homologate the mandate. That I'm going to leave for Anna to discuss a little bit more. Okay. One of the questions that often comes up is, just looking for it, who needs to be interviewed? Well, that's a really good question. And the reason I'm saying this is because, I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong page here. Okay, who needs to be interviewed? I'm sorry. Well, you need family members. We need to confirm the information. Very often, we will use a non-family member as a person who needs to be interviewed as well. So that's to say, either a family doctor or if a person is in fact, a residence, it would be a orderly, it would be a head nurse, and it would be somebody else who could, in fact, confirm that some of this information is accurate. Okay, so it is, in fact, a few people that we do need to interview at the same time. That could be done on a Zoom call, it could be done in person, it could be done by telephone as well. Okay, and what information is the courts looking for? Again, they want to see a timeline which shows the person was capable of doing things, then things got tricky for them where it became much more difficult, and moving on to a person is not able to properly take care of their own needs at this time. So we want to give them the idea of how we got to this place now. The last part of my presentation is how do we word it to the courts? So we just have to be super careful because there are certain words and phrases that one uses when they're applying for homologation to the courts. We know how that often works. We need to explain this sometimes to the family because when we give them a copy of the actual protection mandate that we are submitting to the courts, and they see something that would look like the undersigned noticed, they'll say, "Who's the undersigned?" Well, we are the people who are writing the application, so the undersigned would be us. And I want them to understand that sometimes it's written in a way that the courts are looking for, even though they feel, family members, that we've left out certain information in the story. It's because we're looking more for the pertinent information that we feel that the courts are in fact looking for. So this is my presentation today. I hope that it made some sense to you. Any other questions or anything, of course, you can let Claire know, and I'm sure that she would be happy to pass it on to us. Thank you so much for having us, and I'm going to leave Anna now to do the rest of the presentation.
Thank you, Stephanie. It was very informative, and I personally didn't realize that that psychosocial assessment form is 13 pages long, and it really demonstrates the importance of having when and if possible to have a family member present to be able to help answer some of the questions. I can't imagine if a psychosocial assessment has to be done with for a person that's living alone and no family present. It must be quite complicated. All right, so now Anna's going to explain the next steps once the psychosocial assessment has been done.
Okay, so actually, just to clarify a bit, I'm going to go back and forth. And what I'm going to do for the purposes of this presentation is explain the life cycle of a protection mandate and the life cycle of a tutorship. Because a tutorship would only come into effect if someone is deemed no longer able to make decisions with regards to his or her personal affairs and financial affairs in the event there is no protection or a viable protection mandate in place already. So we'll start with that. We'll start with the actual documentation, make some distinctions, go through the life cycle just to sort of demystify the whole process. Because the medical evaluations and social workers' evaluations They come into play when we start. So usually what happens is that the family will reach out to a notary or a lawyer to start the process to get either the protection mandate that already exists homologated, or if that's impossible or there's nothing in place already, to establish what we call a tutorship. So I'm just going to share my screen here just to make things as clear as possible.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so thank you, Stephanie. So just to jump off of how you just ended your part of the presentation, I am going to go a bit backwards now. So I'm going to explain the legal documents that could be put in place prior to incapacity. And then what is the life cycle? How do they come into effect? How do we work with them? And what happens when we don't have these documents in place? So let's start with the protection mandate that Stephanie explained fairly well. So the protection mandate, it's a document by which you choose the person or persons to represent you in the event of incapacity. So it's a document that we hope to never use. It doesn't need to be used unless we're in a situation of incapacity. But it's all the more important to actually take the time to discuss and project into the future and into the possible scenarios that could come into effect. Because I always say to my clients, because traditionally, protection mandates are done at the same time as estate planning. So last will and testament, a will only comes into effect after we pass away. But the protection mandate could potentially come into effect while we're still alive. So let's make sure to put our wishes on paper and ensure that in the event we're not able to express our opinion or our wishes, that it's very clear and that we've put the thought into it and the thought process was put into it to make things not so much easy, but to clarify what your wishes would be so that the person appointed as your representative has a much easier time and is more capable of representing you and preserving also your rights as much as possible. So as Stephanie already mentioned, a protection mandate comes into effect only by a court judgment. So we call that the homologation process, which essentially means to put into effect. So when you sign a protection mandate, it stays inactive. And you hope it stays inactive forever, but it only comes into effect by virtue of a judgment. And that judgment is only rendered after we receive the psychosocial assessment that Stephanie just described in detail, the medical assessment that Stephanie also discussed. And then we do a procedure, which can be done entirely with a notary, and then at the end, deposit it at the court so that the court can stamp the judgment, or with lawyers in the event that there's conflict, in the event that the person themselves is saying, you know what, I am capable, I'm opposing this, becomes what we call contentious, it's conflictual. Then the notary will need to retract him or herself from the file, and then it becomes a matter that goes before the courts with lawyers. So important to keep that in mind. In terms of the actual drafting of the protection mandate, there's a law that came into effect in November 2022. Any protection mandates done prior to November 1st, 2022, do not need to have what we call a third-party verifier included in these documents. Now, since November 1st, 2022, it is imperative, it's required by law for a third-party verifier to be designated or appointed in a protection mandate. The reason for that is because traditionally speaking or in the past, protection mandates are not subject to any kind of oversight. So they would lead to exploitation, financial mistreatment of many different kinds because they weren't subject to much oversight. So since November 1st, 2022, we're required to appoint a third-party verifier so that in the event of incapacity, if that protection mandate comes into effect, there's a third-party verifier to whom who would be providing an oversight of the transactions of the administration of finances. The point there being to make sure that it's always being used, your finances are always being used in your best interest. Family dynamics play a big role. So It's not advisable in any way to, let's say, if you have four children, to designate only one child to act as the mandatory, knowing that there's a conflict with the other children. There's a lot of case law out there. It's one of the reasons why the courts would set aside a protection mandate. So all that work would fall down the drain anyways. So very important to keep in mind and be very transparent with whomever you're working about the family dynamics. And ideally, you choose somebody who is able to work with the rest of the family. What we do in our practice sometimes, you know, if the person really wants to appoint one person out of several family members, there's different options that we can exercise in order to ensure that the protection mandate would still have an effect in the event of incapacity. The most popular and the most successful is doing a family meeting. So I used to be a social worker in the healthcare system prior to being a notary. And that's something that we transposed into the practice of notary. So the idea there being is that we involve the family members. We don't keep it, you know, under the table. And in the event of incapacity, there's conflict because the other family members did not know who was being appointed and they feel this person is not apt to act as mandatory. By doing the family meeting, all this gets put out on the table. And more importantly, the person who's planning for their incapacity is explaining their wishes. And it's that much harder to contest it and create a situation that could lead to conflict in the event of incapacity. So what happens if you don't have a protection mandate? Well, that's where we go to the parallel regime, which is the tutorship that Stephanie was mentioning. And again, it's a representation measure, meaning that it comes into effect if there's any type of incapacity with regards to personal decisions and or financial decisions. And in the event that a person is deemed to have only incapacity with regards to finances, for example, and there is a protection mandate, a tutorship should be always preferred. And it will be preferred by the courts. A protection mandate will be set aside because a protection mandate essentially strips you of all your civil rights, whereas a tutorship that has only to do with financial, let's say, constraints would preserve your rights as much as possible. So we're getting a bit technical in there, but it's just to know that there are nuances, but a person will never be left without any type of representation. And it also doesn't mean that if you don't have a protection mandate, that the public curator is going to seize your assets. That's something that's thought out there. That's not the situation. Public curator only gets involved and administers person's properties in the event that there's no one in the family who's capable of acting, or there's no one in the entourage who's capable of acting. So it's really a last measure recourse. But to explain the differences between having a protection mandate homologated and then establishing a tutorship, So protection mandate, like I mentioned, gives full powers. A tutorship, there's a lot of oversight. So a person could be designated as tutor, let's say for finances and for personal decisions, but they'll have to report on a yearly basis to a family council. So during the procedure where we're getting the court judgment for the tutorship, we're going to have a family meeting and we're going to designate three people to act as this family council. It's called the tutorship council, but it's three people who are going to be overseeing the administration. So on a yearly basis, the tutor or tutors, plural, will need to render account to the tutorship council and to the public curator. In addition, if there's any real estate that needs to be sold, it's subject to the advice of the family council and then approval by the court. Same thing for any transactions over $40,000. They're subject to the family council's advice and then approval by the court. So these are things that don't come, they're not part of a homologated protection mandate. So in the event you have someone or several persons who you really trust and you're like, you know what, this is the best case scenario for me and my family, I want to designate them, please go and do a protection mandate, because that's the best way to ensure that, you know, things are going to be done appropriately, put your wishes very clearly, even when it comes to housing. If you want to stay at home with private care, put it in writing. If you wish to leave it up to your mandatory, but you wish to be, let's say, in an English-speaking private residence, private room, so on and so forth, put those things in writing. It's important to keep them customized. And I say this and I stress this because in the past, protection mandates have been just, in a sense, accessories to the estate planning process. And in many ways, like I said, they're more important because you're planning in the event of incapacity while you're still alive. So you're put yourself first, you know? So that's one thing I wanted to stress here. So, and sometimes I will go through the process of examining the situation with clients. And if they tell me, you know, I don't completely have someone that I would appoint as mandatory right now. It's not the right time. I really love this person, but you know, they're not apt to act as mandatory. Sometimes it's rare, but sometimes I will say then a protection mandate is not the way to go, because you're better off having an oversight in the event of incapacity and letting a tutorship be established, as opposed to giving carte blanche to someone in the event of incapacity under protection mandate. So that's also something to keep in mind. It doesn't mean the public curator is going to seize your assets. Okay. Powers of attorney. Now, I wanted to really distinguish between powers of attorney and protection mandates. So a power of attorney, from the minute you sign it, it comes into effect. It's not the same as a protection mandate. A power of attorney could be general or it could be specific. It could be unlimited in time. It could be restricted in time. And generally speaking, a power of attorney, not generally, legally speaking, you can only assign a power of attorney for financial decisions. When it comes to personal care decisions and the like, you cannot give a power of attorney. It's only under the protection mandate that you could foresee that in the event of incapacity. And then even in the event of incapacity, if you're able to consent or refuse treatment, that's a special protection that's under our civil code. So something to keep in mind also. Oftentimes, I find that it's a misunderstanding in the healthcare system or the residential system, where they think under a power of attorney, it also provides a right to decide for care. So that's just something to keep in mind. Traditionally speaking, they open the door to exploitation. So they're to be used with extreme caution, powers of attorney. That being said, I do think that they have their place. And one of the main reasons why people choose to do a power of attorney is a general power of attorney. So as Stephanie aptly mentioned, in the event of incapacity, a power of attorney is no longer to produce effects. It's only while someone is capable of acting and they have someone that they provide the authorization to act as their proxy. So by fiction of the law, though, our civil code has an article that says that during the time it takes to get the judgment that homologates a protection mandate or to establish a tutorship, if it's not contested, the power of attorney can continue to produce effects. So that's the gray zone period that could take around 6 months to 1 year to obtain the judgment. By the time we get the social workers' evaluations, medical evaluations, who knows? There's a time lapse there where we know for a fact that the person's not capable, let's say, in fact, to make decisions on their own, but we don't have the judgment and we're not declared incapable without the judgment. So by fiction of the law, during that gray zone period, the power of attorney can produce effects so as to ensure that the person doesn't end up in the red, so the bills can continue to be paid, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's important to keep in mind. Do I need a protection mandate? We already discussed this. So it depends always. Family dynamics play a role. If you do wish to limit the role that the public curator will play in terms of oversight, and you have people that you trust and you want to establish your own oversight committee, let's say, do a protection mandate. Do you want to set out your wishes with regards to care? You know, there's a lot of things to keep in mind. This one, actually, we hadn't touched on. It's really important. At the bottom, I'm saying, do you wish to ensure that your property is used for yours and your spouse's and your children's benefit? Let's say you have a dependent child or your spouse. Let's say everything is intermingled. In the event one of you becomes incapable, especially if you've designated one another as mandatory, if you don't provide for a conflict of interest clause, let's say, so if you don't provide for the fact that your property can be used not only for your best interest, but also for your spouse's best interest, he or she can be brought to task. And they could be considered acting in conflict of interest, even if the property is being used in the same way it was used prior to the event of incapacity. So important to know that if you do wish to ensure that certain people remain supported, if you're, let's say, the major breadwinner there, it could become an issue for your spouse or dependent children. When and why would you need a power of attorney? So if you have a trusted family member, friend, professional, we went over this already. So it's the main advantage here is that time lapse. And what I do oftentimes with clients is that we'll have it done, but I don't issue any copies. I keep it in my vault. And only in the event of incapacity, once they prove it, or under the client's instructions, clear instructions, because it's always your documents, then we release the copies. So there's ways of working with your notary or legal professional to make sure that you could have this in place without actually giving a power of attorney right now to someone who could use it, let's say, okay, if it's not necessary. Misuses of powers of attorney, I already explained them. So this is really the traditional way that exploitation or financial mistreatment would occur. So if someone starts using it for his or her personal needs, and oftentimes I've seen, and Stephanie, you've probably seen it too, it's a matter of miseducation or misinformation. So a person who has a power of attorney often thinks, I'm making all the decisions now. I have the power of attorney, also because of the name, right? Power of attorney. It's not. I always bring in the people who are being appointed so that I can explain to them what are their duties under power of attorney. They're acting really as a proxy. They're not to act on their own volition, and they're not to use it for their own personal needs, i.e. let's say paying mortgage, your own personal mortgage with a parent's account for who you have a power of attorney. This is just something that oftentimes comes in the same lengthways. People will often ask, you know, what if I just give my property while I'm still alive, instead of waiting for after I pass away? I mean, it's fine, but always in terms of later life planning, if that's something you wish to do, bring in, and we often work with other professionals, bring in, you know, your financial planner, your accountant, project in the future and see, well, what if I need private care? Do I have enough if I give away, let's say, my major asset? So yes, giving is great. I'm always for it. If it works, and if you can ensure that you have enough for the future, because we don't know what could happen in the future. The verifier, so I mentioned the role of the verifier. This is actually a really important thing, and it also protects the mandatory, the person you're designating as representative. It also protects him or her from any kind of reprisals. So by designating a verifier, which is required ever since November 1st, 2022, you're ensuring that there's an oversight. The choice of verifier is important in the sense that you should name someone who knows you, who knows your wishes, but who's also good at verifying finances and who could also maybe guide the person you've appointed as mandatory. Good to have also some replacements there, but just discuss the role of the verifier with your notary or lawyer, whoever you work with, to do your planning. So on your first consultation, what to tell your legal professional, be open. The family situation is extremely important. Your financial situation is also important. Explain the nature of what you're dealing with, what it is that you're concerned about, and discuss the different options that are available to you. And whenever possible, work with other professionals, bring them all in together, because that's always been the most comprehensive. And that's how we worked when we were in social work. We brought in the other professionals because, you know, when you're dealing with a plan, with creating a plan, it's customized. You know, there's certain directions to be taken depending on the scenarios, but let's customize as much as possible and bring in the trusted professionals who've known you for so many years who could provide a different insight. Here, estates to avoid, and I'm just going to skip this one. Just a quick note on medical aid and dying, because I know it's something that's come into a lot of people's purview with regards to, a lot of time when people are discussing protection mandate, they confuse it with medical aid and dying. So just to do an overview, right now, medical aid and dying is possible if you have the capacity to consent to it, and there's a strict protocol to follow, and consent is verified on many different occasions. There was a law that was passed saying that people can plan for medical aid in dying, and the notaries would be the ones to execute the deeds to do it. It's not possible yet. So it's not something that's possible. It needs to be done with a lot of care. It's being done in an interdisciplinary fashion. I am on a team that's researching and going over what's going on with the notaries right now to see about how to do an anticipated request for medical aid in dying, and it's still not clear. It's going to have to be done in an interdisciplinary fashion, but just to keep in mind, it's not something that can be done right now. And so if there are any notaries who are providing that service, just know that it's not legal at this time. Okay, so it's something that's possible only if you have the capacity to consent, which is verified at many different stages. So to do it in advance, there's still a lot of demystifying and a rigorous procedure to be put in place before we can do something like that. That's it.
Thank you so much, Anna, for this very comprehensive also presentation. And I think that what you've both demonstrated is, oh my gosh, the amount of education that we have to go in as a in terms of like care partners. I mean, you're not only dealing with the disease, but you're dealing with so many legal aspects that are associated with it. And I think an important lesson is, you know, as much as we can make our wishes clear while we're healthy, the better off we will be. Because it's like you're saying, Anna, like you have to really specify, like, it's not only, you know, just the big wishes. It's like the minute details, like I was listening, like what type of room and all of this stuff. The question that I have though is, so dementia causes another illness called anosognosia, which means loss of insight, and whereby, unfortunately, when it's time for family members to have to get the protection mandate, the person living with the illness is in complete denial that anything is wrong, right? Which for sure causes family conflict. How do you deal with a person who is resisting to have that psychosocial assessment, resisting to have that protection mandate, have decisions on their behalf? So maybe I'll start with you, Stephanie. What do you say? And then Anna, how do you deal with that?
So that's so interesting. I just had this file that you're referring to. And I have to tell you, I had to be really careful how to document it, because instead of it going into a contested type of situation, I had to really specify and outline, as the doctor in his medical evaluation wrote, that this, in fact, diagnosis was done, which is why there is a real lack of insight into the person actually having a dementia, which is a complicated topic all to start with. Luckily, in this file, the client did have a protection mandate in place. So a family member had come forward and said, look, we would like to start the process of homologation. I do have to be clear to the family, and I'm sure, you know, Anna could agree, just because we do the psychosocial evaluation and the medical and we submit it then to the notary who then forwards it to the courts, doesn't mean that it will automatically go through. This is something that the courts take quite seriously. They need to review all of the information and make sure, in fact, that this is this is something that the protection mandate should, in fact, go ahead and be homologated with.
Anna, how about, what is your view on it?
So, I mean, throughout the process to actually homologate, so when the application is made to homologate a mandate or to open a tutorship, we're always going to serve the person themselves by bailiff. It's part of the procedure. So it's something that I'm always advising the family of, and we always coordinate with the bailiff so that it's done in the most respectful way possible. But that being said, the whole reason behind it is so that the person themselves is aware that this procedure is happening and it's not just happening behind their backs. And that gives them the right to, and I would actually, you know, sometimes when these types of situations arise and the family's like, we don't know how to deal with it, I sometimes advise that it's best that they have someone to represent them themselves, because as a notary, yes, I'm representing the person's best interests and that's what's guiding me in the procedure. But to have them maybe have their own lawyer, if they have the means for it, representing their interests. And that way they can also have their say in the procedure. And if necessary, they could get evaluated by their own professional, by their own doctor, and have another evaluation. And if that goes against, then we have a situation that would have to be, you know, a more deep dive would have to be done in terms of determining, is there an incapacity issue, or is there ways for us to preserving some of the capacity that's there? And that's the whole point of the last law that came into effect. So we've really shifted from protection to preserving autonomy as much as possible. And if that's something that could be possible, then yeah, one way of dealing with that is to have the person themselves represented and maybe having another evaluation done, and really guiding and making sure that they're involved in the process as much as possible so that they don't feel like they're being imposed something. That's the way that we usually deal with it.
You know, an important point though that you brought up is the family meetings, you know, mm-hmm. And I, in my practice, when I work with family members, I also see conflict among siblings, for example. because there's a lack of communication, right? Like one person takes the lead and they're not informing. And you know, you really emphasize the importance of family meetings, that everybody understand, that everybody's on the same page, that everybody really, you know, I like the part about, you know, appointing somebody that will get along with everyone, you know, when possible. But, you know, I think as compared to other illnesses, you know, dementia is probably one of the most expensive diseases to manage financially as the disease evolves. And it also is probably one of those diseases that causes so much family conflict. And so it's important to, as much as possible, everybody be on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, what I would love to do is, you know, you both have a wealth of experience. I know that you're both also McGill grads, so you had a great education from McGill University. I'm going to put up on the screen Stephanie's contact information that you had shared with us, and Anna will be putting up your contact information as well, so that people could feel free to reach out to the both of you for more information and to have your help along this very, what can be a very difficult journey. So thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
This webcast is an initiative of the McGill University Dementia Education Program, which is funded by private donations. If you would like to make a contribution to our program or for more information, please visit us at mcgill.ca/dementia. And if you would like to join our mailing list to be notified about upcoming episodes of McGill Cares, as well as other important information about our programs and resources, you can email us at dementia@mcgill.ca or sign up for a newsletter on our website. Thank you for watching.